This week on America Interrupted from the PBS NewsHour, as the U.S. grapples with reopening and containing the coronavirus, how has the UK managed the pandemic?
This is just fraught with difficulty, and I think there have been lots of successes too.
And what lessons can the US learn?
If you protect the vulnerable, then that's the way forward, isn't it? But the economy is wrecked. It really is. And I don't know how we're going to get through all this.
Listen and subscribe to America Interrupted wherever you get your podcasts.
Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Coronavirus countermeasures. Senate Republicans in the White House propose to curtail jobless benefits despite a historically high unemployment rate. Then, use of force. Federal agents ordered into multiple American cities prompts nationwide protests against their presence. And 30 years after, we examine what the Americans with Disabilities Act has accomplished, its successes, and the many challenges that remain.
Granting rights and really being able to be accepted by society is something that we're still striving for.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Republicans in the U.S. Senate say they are ready tonight with a new $1 trillion COVID-19 relief plan. It comes as the nation's pandemic death toll nears 150,000. It also comes ahead of a Friday deadline for federal jobless benefits to expire. Reports say the Republican bill cuts them from $600 a week additional to $200. We'll get details after the news summary. Final stage trials got underway today in the biggest COVID vaccine study so far. The first of 30,000 volunteers received dosages at sites around the U.S. The vaccine was developed at record speed by the National Institutes of Health and by drug maker Moderna. But the head of the Food and Drug Administration promised that safety still comes first.
Although we have gone at significant speed to get to this point, our job at FDA and our solemn promise to the American people is that we will judge based upon the data and upon the gold standard that we have at FDA regarding the safety and efficacy of a vaccine.
Presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden called for President Trump to commit to no White House involvement in vaccine development. Meanwhile, the White House confirmed that National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien has the virus and is self-isolating. President Trump said today that he had not seen O'Brien lately. Major League Baseball also has an outbreak just days after finally beginning its season. The Miami Dolphins called off tonight's home opener amid reports that at least 14 players have COVID-19. That in turn forced the cancellation of the New York Yankees game tonight in Philadelphia, where Miami had played over the weekend. The body of civil rights icon and Georgia Congressman John Lewis has arrived in Washington for one last time. A motorcade carried his casket into the city today, stopping at the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, and the Black Lives Matter Plaza near the White House. Later in the Capitol Rotunda, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi led the tributes to Lewis.
He understood the power of young people to change the future. When asked what someone can do who is 19 or 20 years old, the age that he was when he set out to desegregate Nashville, Lewis replied, "A young person should be speaking out for what is fair, what is just, what is right."
Former Vice President Biden was among those paying final respects to the congressman. He will lie in state through tomorrow. Six American cities are appealing to Congress to bar deployments of federal agents. The mayors of Albuquerque, Chicago, Kansas City, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. made that request today. It followed new violence in Portland and other cities over the weekend. We'll return to this later in the program. South Texas and northern Mexico faced more rain and flooding today from remnants of Hurricane Hanna. The storm made landfall Saturday near Port Mansfield, Texas, as a Category 1 storm. It wrecked boats, tore up marinas, and flooded communities near Corpus Christi. More than 200,000 customers lost power in an area already hard hit by COVID-19. Separately, Hurricane Douglas narrowly missed Hawaii on Sunday, sweeping just north of the islands. The storm brought heavy rain to Maui and piled up massive waves off of Honolulu, but no major damage was reported. In China, the U.S. consulate in the western city of Chengdu officially closed today. It is retaliation for the U.S. shutting down China's consulate in Houston. Chinese authorities entered the now empty Chengdu consulate in protective gear, while onlookers lamented the rising tensions with the U.S.
We are all ordinary Chinese citizens, but I still pay great attention to the relationship between China and the U.S. Because we need to go and travel in the U.S. and some of our relatives need to go and study in the U.S., these things will all be greatly affected, including the economy between these two countries, which will gradually deteriorate and even break apart.
The U.S. has four other consulates in China. Civilian casualties in Afghanistan are down 13% so far this year from the same period last year. The United Nations reports that the total killed and wounded was just short of 3,500 through June. It is due in part to fewer attacks by international forces since a U.S. withdrawal agreement with the Taliban. Back in this country, lawyers for President Trump are trying again to block the release of his tax returns. They asked a federal court in New York today to quash a subpoena from the Manhattan District Attorney, arguing that it's overly broad. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected an earlier claim that the president is immune from criminal subpoenas. There is word that Google will let employees work from home until at least next July. Today's decision by the company affects nearly 200,000 employees and contract workers. And on Wall Street, stocks started the week on an upbeat note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 114 points to close at 26,584. The Nasdaq rose 173 points, and the S&P 500 added 23. And a quick correction. Just a moment ago, I meant to say the Florida Marlins when reporting the baseball story. My apology. Still to come on the NewsHour, Republicans in the Senate join with the White House to propose a plan to curtail extra jobless benefits. More federal agents in American cities prompt nationwide protests. We examine the successes and remaining challenges of the Americans with Disabilities Act, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It has been months since the last coronavirus relief bill and the extra $600 a week that it granted in unemployment benefits is set to expire on Friday. That is leaving millions of Americans in limbo as Congress debates what comes next. Today, Republicans unveiled their proposed bill. Our Lisa Desjardins is here to explain how close Congress is to a deal. So, Lisa, this is all happening late in the day after days of disagreements, Republicans finally giving some public specifics. What are you hearing?
That's right. Just in the last hour, Judy, Republicans have unveiled their specific proposals and legislative text. As we speak, Leader McConnell is at the microphone explaining it to reporters. And I can tell you a little bit about what's in it. They are proposing direct payment checks for most Americans of $1,200 per person. There would be an extra amount if you have an adult dependent, say a college student. Also in this bill, there would be some additional money for schools. I think we're going to be talking about that for the next couple of days, as well as some money for unemployment benefits that I think is important to dissect. And Republicans are pushing liability protection so that businesses would be harder to sue them for anything related to the coronavirus.
And so, Lisa, tell us a little bit more about what they're saying about these extended unemployment benefits. It had been an additional $600 a week. The Democrats wanted that to continue. Now we're hearing from Republicans what they're prepared to do.
That's right. This is so important. This will affect 20 million Americans. It's already affecting them. Now, again, let's look at what we're talking about here. First, as you said, Judy, right now, there are $600 per week in added benefits because of the pandemic. However, Republicans would change that in their proposal to $200 per week instead, and they would ultimately want to change that to 70% of wages. Instead of that $200 flat rate. For some people, that 70% will be more, especially if you're higher income. For other people, that will be less than $200 if you're lower income. Republicans in general say their philosophy here is that they think this added amount of money for unemployment is discouraging people from staying on the job, encouraging them to stay on unemployment. That's why they want to bring it down to a lower amount. But Judy, Democrats raise a couple of points on their own. They say if you change this amount at all from the $600 to anything else, that alone will take weeks for state unemployment offices to adjust to. And if you change the entire way of going about it, say to a percentage formula, that could take months. Judy, while the deadline for this money runs out Friday, technically, many of these states have already said that they will not issue this money in the next check. So, Judy, because Congress hasn't acted on these unemployment benefits, we know a week from today, people getting unemployment benefits will see $600 less. Congress may try and backfill that later, but right now there will be a gap for those families.
Well, Lisa, with so many people dependent on whether it's these expanded unemployment benefits or other aspects of this relief plan, when does it look as if there could be an agreement, a deal?
Let's look at the calendar. It's very tight, Judy. If you look at just today, for example, here's Monday. Congress on Friday faces that unemployment deadline when money runs out for these enhanced benefits. Then if you look at the next date on the calendar, that's the end of the first week of August. That's when Congress wants to leave almost until November. Now, what other dates are on our minds? August 17th, that is when the Democratic convention begins. So Congress really is trying to get all of this done in 2 weeks. But Judy, they are very far apart. Republicans don't even agree amongst themselves. It's not clear that this proposal I've talked to you about could pass amongst Republicans, much less Democrats, who now are sitting down with Republicans to see if they can make a deal. They're very far apart at this moment.
It certainly does sound like it. Well, I know you're going to be watching it, and everybody's waiting to see what happens. Finally, Lisa, today is the day the United States Capitol, the Congress, members of Congress say farewell to civil rights icon John Lewis. I know you covered him. You've talked to so many members. What does losing him mean to them?
This was a profound moment, I think, for most every member of Congress in both parties. You know, Representative Lewis is the first African-American to lie in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Others, Rosa Parks, for example, Officer Jacob Chestnut, have been there in repose, but not lying in state as an official. So it's a high honor. Senator Tim Scott, another African-American, a Republican, said it was a hero's farewell and deserved.
Certainly so. Certainly so. Lisa Desjardins covering it all for us. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
Protesters and police again clashed in a number of U.S. cities over the weekend. In Portland, Oregon, the Trump administration is reportedly sending more federal agents to the city to deal with nightly confrontations there, according to the Washington Post. As Amna Nawaz reports, some of the crowds who initially protested the killing of George Floyd are now also confronting an intense federal force. And a note, this report contains some violent audio and images.
In the pre-dawn hours on the streets of Portland, clashes intensified between protesters and federal agents. Those agents used tear gas to try and disperse crowds from a federal courthouse. The building has become a rallying point for protests against police violence.
I came here to try to hold the people who are supposed to be keeping us safe accountable for their atrocious actions that they've been committing on the city.
Black Lives Matter!
Since the killing of George Floyd, Portland's seen regular demonstrations, overwhelmingly peaceful, against police brutality and racial injustice. But since the arrival of federal agents from the Department of Homeland Security 3 weeks ago, tensions have escalated, leading to more confrontations in the streets. A Sunday demonstration that began peacefully ramped up overnight. Protesters shot fireworks at the courthouse and officers responded with tear gas. Demonstrators held umbrellas as shields and used leaf blowers to push back the gas. Today, Portland police say they found Molotov cocktails and loaded rifle magazines in a park. On Sunday, Acting Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, said what federal agents faced was beyond, quote, normal criminal activity.
They're coming armed with rocks, bottles, baseball bats, power tools, commercial-grade fireworks, eliciting that violence and targeting their violence on federal courthouse and federal law enforcement officers.
Earlier this morning, President Trump defended the administration's response, tweeting, "We are protecting federal property." Though peaceful protests continue across the country, Portland is one of a handful of cities that saw episodes of violence this weekend. In Seattle, social media video shows police pepper spraying protesters. One officer swings at a demonstrator with a club. In Oakland, California, protesters lit a courthouse on fire. In Richmond, Virginia, vehicles were set ablaze. Outside Denver, in Aurora, Colorado, two people were shot and wounded after a car drove through a protest. And in Austin, Texas, one protester was shot and killed after a motorist plowed into the crowd. Police say the driver was also the gunman. Federal authorities blame protesters and say the violence justifies their increased presence. But demonstrators and many city leaders say that presence is only making matters worse. As we mentioned, Seattle is one of the cities that's seen street demonstrations grow in both size and intensity in recent days. Jenny Durkin is Seattle's Democratic mayor and joins me now. Mayor Durkin, thanks for making the time and welcome to the NewsHour. We should note that a lot of protesters in Seattle said that they were out in the streets because of what they saw unfolding in Portland. Now that the administration says that there's going to be more federal agents going to Portland, what do you think the effect will be in your city, in Seattle?
I think it's going to have a negative impact in Seattle and in Portland and in cities across the country. I've talked to other mayors, and a number of people saw escalating protests both in size and intensity. And in Seattle, people clearly said they joined because of what was happening in Portland. In fact, the largest protest was designated as a protest in solidarity with Portland. I think adding agents is the wrong direction in Portland. I think that we need to have a strategy that does not escalate tensions, but actually resolves them.
Let me ask you about some of your conversations with the administration, though, because you have been in touch with the Acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf. You said it was as recently as Thursday afternoon. You made it clear you don't want federal agents coming to Seattle. By Friday, there were reports that federal agents had deployed a tactical team to Seattle. So help us understand, when and how did you learn that there were federal agents in your city?
So on Thursday, I spoke with the acting secretary, made it clear to him what our position was, and he told me that they were not going to surge agents to Seattle, that he did not see the need to do so. We then learned shortly after that from media reports that agents had indeed landed in Seattle. We asked for clarification. We've gotten some assurances that they are there just on standby if there is the need at a federal property. But we've had additional conversations both with the United States Attorney here, with the Department of Homeland Security, and we've also asked for congressional help because we want to have clear understanding of what the federal agents are going to be doing here. The worst thing for Seattle would be if things escalated like they did in Portland, and we really want to avoid that. We're urging all protesters to be peaceful, but we're also urging the federal government, please, we don't need you to take the steps here in Seattle that you're taking in Portland. It's the wrong thing for Seattle.
Mayor Durkin, to be clear, since there are already federal agents in your city, do you know how many there are, what their mandate is? Do you know if they've already been operating in any way or arrested anyone?
To our knowledge, they have not arrested anyone, nor have they been doing any visible operations. We have not had any direct protest at those federal facilities, so it is unclear how many agents are there or what posture they would take. It's one reason we are continuing to ask for clarification from the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that we don't see the kind of surge and escalation here in Seattle that we've seen continually in Portland. But we also are planning as if that could occur and taking the steps we need to do to make sure that the community understands what the potential is, and really asking people to protest peacefully. You know, we want to make sure that not only do we not have that kind of escalation, but it seems in Portland that there are two people, you know, the federal government is intent on having the fight, and there are some people in that crowd who are intent on giving them the fight. And we don't want that happening in Seattle.
Mayor Durkan, as you point out, your critics will point to the fact that for weeks, protesters several weeks ago had basically taken control of a few downtown city blocks. Your police chief had to go in earlier this month with heavy machinery and riot gear to clear that area. There was already concern about violence over the weekend. The police chief called it a riot on Saturday night. Do you think that the presence of federal forces could help quell these protests before they get out of control, and something similar to what happened before happens again, where protesters are able to take over some chunk of city space?
I think that when you saw that the area on Capitol Hill that we were able to return to normal, that our police were able to go in there and clear that area with very little conflict and restore it back to a place that all the neighborhood and businesses could enjoy it. Contrast that what's going on in Portland, where night after night after night, it is proven that what they're doing is not working. They have not quelled anything. To the contrary, they have escalated it. So I do not believe that there's any evidence whatsoever that any of the strategies that the president is trying to employ will lead to peace. And I don't think he wants it to. He's been very clear that what he is doing is targeting cities that are led by Democrats to show that there can be division and the lack of law and order so that he can run on that as a president. That kind of political maneuvering of law enforcement really is un-American, and I think it's dangerous for us to go down that path.
Mayor Durkan, very briefly, you weren't told before the current federal team that's on the ground in Seattle was sent in. Do you have any assurance you'll be told in advance of any further deployment?
So the assistant secretary did say he would call the chief of police and myself if the posture changed, but I know that, look, there's one person who's guiding the activities of this administration, and that's the President of the United States. And so regardless of assurances that anyone else might give me or any other local government official, we have to take the president at his word, and he keeps escalating his rhetoric, and then the behavior follows that rhetoric. And so as a mayor of a city, I will tell you, I do need the federal government's help. I need more testing for COVID-19. I need to make sure that as this health emergency gets worse, that my hospitals can withstand it. I need the kids who are not going to be back in school to be able to learn. That's the kind of help we need from this federal government that we don't get. A president should step forward and lead the nation. And instead, he's dividing the nation. And I think it's a really dangerous time for America to be on this point of inflection in our history. And what our choices today will decide what happens for generations of Americans to come.
That is the mayor of Seattle, Jenny Durkan, joining us tonight. Thank you so much, Madam Mayor.
Thank you very much.
This week marks the 30th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, a groundbreaking law that prohibits discrimination based on disability. The legislation has been invaluable for what it changed, but significant obstacles still exist for those who have physical or mental impairments of any kind. When President George H.W. Bush signed the law in 1990, it guaranteed new protections for work, education, access, and transportation, among other rights. Many of the physical accommodations that are now commonplace only came to pass after the ADA became law. In fact, as seen in the Netflix documentary, Crip Camp, it took longer to guarantee these basic civil rights than it did for other groups, including Black Americans, Latinos, and Asians. And a generation of advocates took to the streets to demonstrate and protest through the 1970s and 80s. But even after all this time, the challenges for people with disabilities remain enormous. Just 32% of working-age Americans with disabilities have a job. People with disabilities also live in poverty at more than twice the rate of people without disabilities. We're going to explore these questions more in a moment. But first, the NewsHour spoke with a number of Americans and asked them to reflect on what it means to live with a disability today.
My name is Brittany Wilson. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm a disabled civil rights attorney. I have cerebral palsy.
Hi, my name is Bill Krebs. I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm a person with a disability myself. You may not know it. It's a hidden disability.
My name is Elizabeth Bostick. I am first and foremost the proud parent and humble servant of King James. He has a rare disease called kinicterus, which is caused by severe jaundice at birth.
I'm Jen Dierenwater. I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. I'm also bisexual, two-spirit, and I am multiply disabled with chronic illnesses.
My name is Alice Wong, and I'm a disabled activist in San Francisco.
My name is Max Barrows. I am a person on the autism spectrum. I speak up for people with disabilities throughout the state.
I think it's safe to say that my life wouldn't be anything that it is right now because the ADA literally gave me my rights as a disabled person. The fact that I was able to attend law school and receive accommodations and to be employed as an attorney. But I think also as a civil rights lawyer in particular, I know the limitations of the law. That's what the ADA is. At the end of the day, it's just a statute. It gave us the bare minimum, which is our rights. And rights are not anything if they're not enforceable.
Well, before that, the ADA, kids like myself were segregated in school. We didn't have no education. We were never heard, never seen, never did anything. Employment was the hardest thing for people with disabilities. We were placed in shelter workshop programs where we just sat there and did nothing. We did some minimum wage jobs. We made a whole dollar. Well, I was there for 10 years of my life. I thought as a person with a disability, I would go nowhere. So I started being a self-advocate.
When I think about ADA, you know, the key word for me is access. And that coupled with a number of other disability laws really gave everyone the ability to have access to whatever tools were necessary, any reasonable accommodations were necessary to be able to live as independently as possible. And so as his mother, of course, one of my primary concerns is, can he effectively communicate his wants, his needs, his desires, to live the life that he wants to live and to be in charge of it. And so a lot of technology has been built as a result of that because there was a demand for it.
You know, one of the caveats of the ADA was to try to stop the institutionalization of disabled people. Well, that's not really ended. Like, yes, we do have more options, but disabled people are being institutionalized all the time. I can't tell you the number of times I've had medical providers or, you know, healthcare workers try to put me in a nursing home. I don't need to be in a nursing home. Just make sure I have a disability accessible apartment and a home health aid, and I can mostly get by on my own.
I do think, especially with the pandemic, by right to health care and to be protected from discrimination is really important. I am legit worried about coming down with COVID-19 and not being a priority or considered a life worth saving, that these attitudes will not be fixed by a law. These are vulgar, more difficult cultural changes that need to happen. And that takes time.
We're still not seen as independent or productive people in many areas because we rarely are given the opportunity to prove ourselves. And people should let us be in the driver's seat of making decisions for ourselves. And who knows us better than we know ourselves?
Let's look at the changes and the challenges with a pair of activists from two different generations. Judy Heumann is a lifelong civil rights activist. She sued the New York City Board of Education to become that city's first teacher to use a wheelchair. She's led numerous protests to force institutions and public buildings to become more accessible. And she served as a special advisor on disability rights for the U.S. State Department. And Carrie Gray helped organize people with disabilities in a protest just last month in front of the White House as part of Black Disabled Lives Matter. She is with the American Association of People with Disabilities. And we welcome both of you to the NewsHour. Judy Heumann, this has been a cause for you going back to your days as a teenager. What does this particular anniversary mean for you when you think about the contributions of the ADA?
I think the Americans with Disabilities Act is an amazingly important piece of legislation. It has allowed us as disabled people to see that our coalition work over the decades before 1990 resulted in an acknowledgement on the part of the Congress that discrimination was pervasive across the United States and that it needed to intervene to grant us our rights. That being said, like many of the previous speakers have said, granting rights and really being able to be accepted by society is something that we're still striving for. And I think when we look at the fact that the built environment, including interpreters and captioning and other types of accommodations other than employment, we've made really great progress. But when we look at the data in the area of employment, I think that really speaks an amazing amount about how much further we have to go. And those figures are pre-COVID.
And Carrie Gray, you were born the year the ADA was signed. You've grown up under this law. What has it meant to you?
The ADA has meant a lot of different things. I think that one of the first things I think about is the ADA and what it has done for inclusion and perception. So we know that 1 in 5 people across the United States have a disability, but it's still not widely known that disability is not just the summation of your medical conditions, but is a legal term that gives you access to your human rights. So I mention that because disability is often used as a description that defines people's relationship to their physical and mental health, and often hospitals and things of that nature. Most people don't get excited or feel empowered about having to constantly access their health. And there's a lot of people with disabilities that have rough stories around all of the questions that people can have around, like, how much can this person do and contribute to society? So I think for me, one of the first things that I think about outside of the specifics of the ADA is just how it ensures that we're defining disability as a legal term that grants people access to human rights. So I'm excited about what is done and how much more we're going to do moving forward.
Picking up on that, Judy, when you said you said there's a difference, it's one thing to be granted the rights, it's another thing to be truly accepted. So pick up on that.
So one of the positive parts of the ADA is the growing strength of the disability rights movement. The depth of the movement, the racial diversity of the movement that's coming forward, the sexual orientation, religion, on and on. People are more able to come forward and be their full selves, including having disability as a central part of who we are, and not looking at disability as a negative. I think more and more people are looking at disability as a natural, normal part of life and something that we do not want to be seen as a medical condition, but rather as part of the civil rights movement, fighting not just for the rights of disabled people, but for the rights of all people who are marginalized.
And Carrie Gray, those are exactly the kinds of things I hear when I talk to people with disabilities of all ages, and especially the younger generation. When you think about priorities during your lifetime, what are they? What do you most want to see change?
I think there's two areas that I'm thinking of in particular. One, employment is so important to, you know, people across our country. We're having to figure out, how do we survive? How do we take care of ourselves? How do we thrive even as people with disabilities, and also people with disabilities who have other existing identities such as race and gender and so many different things. And so employment becomes a question and a situation that all of us have to explore. I think that we've seen that the ADA has given us a lot of access to make sure that we can defend ourselves when situations of discrimination do occur.
I think it's everyone. Everyone has a stake in this. The entities that are not allowed to discriminate need to understand not only what discrimination is, they need to understand what the remedies are. And I think in many cases, and COVID is a great example, people being denied the right to work at home who have disabilities or didn't have disabilities, and how we were able to really quickly convert over to virtual. Now, I'm not saying disabled people should only work virtually at all, but I am saying that when a crisis occurred, people were able to do things that they said they couldn't do before. I believe it's very important for the leadership of business to make sure that their human resource people understand what their obligations are, that their staff are trained. I also think it's very important that the general citizen in the United States recognize the fact that disability is something that we can acquire at any point in our life. And it's not a threatening comment. It's a reality comment. And so in part, what we're saying is, learn from us, work with us, help us move forward in our lives, and help you prepare for your future life or other loved ones in your family.
And Carrie, I am curious to know where you see the responsibility lies from making these changes that need to be made.
I absolutely agree with Judy. Everyone has to do their part to ensure that we not only have this piece of legislation, but that it is being enforced throughout everyone's entities. And so as an individual, we have to get to the point where we are documenting our experiences and we're speaking out against any situation that can be harmful to us as individuals and our community. The company has to make sure that they understand what their role is in this and how they can be creating environments that are inclusive of all people, including people with disabilities. So I think when all of us play our role, government, company, the individual, we are actually getting towards that journey and success of full disability rights.
We have a long way to go.
Well, it's something for all of us to think about on this 30th anniversary of the ADA. I do hope all Americans spend some time thinking about their responsibility. Judy Heumann, Carrie Gray, thank you both.
Thank you.
India has reported more than 1 million COVID cases, a number exceeded only by the U.S. and Brazil. Special correspondent Fred DeSam Lazaro reports on the situation in Delhi. It's part of his series, Agents for Change.
Namaste, Ji.
These women are India's foot soldiers in the fight against the coronavirus. Their job, to find and help those with symptoms. They are called accredited social health activists, or ASHA workers, in remote villages in cramped urban slums. Across India, more than 1 million women like Bhagwan Devi and Kundan Devi fan out on foot each day. Until the pandemic, they would mostly check on pregnant women or see that children are up to date on their shots.
Put your mask on.
Now they have a more dangerous mission.
We have to check for patients, we bring them oximeters, take their daily readings.
This they add with little guidance or even protective gear from the authorities.
If masks are available, we get them. Otherwise, we have to buy our own. And gloves? If we want gloves, we're on our own.
Global health experts say ASHA workers are a key but so far poorly utilized resource to help contain the coronavirus in a country struggling to emerge from a 3-month lockdown. traffic has been slowly returning to Delhi's streets and shops have begun to open. The crowds are much smaller than pre-COVID times, except in food markets. Here, social distancing is just not an option. Like much of urban India, this city is bracing itself. Hospitals across India have been overwhelmed with COVID cases. In Delhi, a temporary 500-bed overflow facility with limited medical equipment has been set up for people suffering COVID symptoms. There's also a new 10,000-bed quarantine center, the world's largest. Many of the city's 20 million residents live in crowded single-room spaces.
30% of the people don't have spare rooms if they have COVID at their homes.
I reached Manish Sisodia, Delhi's deputy chief minister.
For people who feel any discomfort, even if they are in asymptomatic conditions, they can be brought to these centers.
As Delhi prepares for a surge in COVID cases, there's been little evidence of any surge in economic activity several weeks after the lockdown ended.
Sir, there's no work. There's just no work.
Across the city each morning, tradesmen wait at labor chowks or exchanges for employers or their agents to come by with work offers, usually in construction. Like the majority of workers in India's economy, they are informal or off the books, paid by the day. So no work means no pay.
I have three daughters. Our family is in a terrible situation. We get food from here and there, and I'm not alone. All poor people are in this situation.
The poor often suffer the worst because they have the least ability to gain access to basic essential services during those periods.
Raj Punjabi is a Harvard physician who also heads Last Mile Health, a group that serves hard-to-reach regions in developing countries. Punjabi says the government ended the lockdown to ease the extreme economic hardships, but it still doesn't test enough people for COVID and, critically, isn't properly tracking contacts of those who test positive.
Then essentially one person goes on to infect three people. And if that scenario plays out just 10 times, the first case will have led to more than 59,000 cases. But if any one of those first few patients was isolated, you dramatically stop the transmission rate.
Frankly, it was hard to manage because in India, systems are not online.
Besides not being online, he admits, Delhi had a rough start. Test results took 2 to 3 days, allowing infections to spread. Testing capacity still lags far behind cities like New York, but it has quadrupled since the early days, with a fleet of mobile units testing some 25,000 people per day, and with quicker results.
Now you can get the result in maximum 1 hour, so that is helping.
India's government is also touting an app that lets smartphone owners know of any nearby active COVID cases. The government says it's had more than 100 million downloads. The problem is not everyone owns a smartphone, including many ASHA workers. They are officially classified as volunteers, so they get no benefits and a monthly stipend as low as 1,000 rupees or $13.
I don't have the salary. I can buy gloves or pay the rent or feed myself. What do? We're scared because if they're positive, we have to touch their bodies. We can only hope that we don't become sick.
For all the extra work with coronavirus, we get nothing. The 1,000 rupees we get, will that even buy medicines if I get sick?
We've neglected these frontline and community health workers, and often we've neglected women in the workforce, especially poor women.
Dr. Punjabi says ASHA workers could be a huge asset since they're ideally positioned to do contact tracing. But the reality on the ground is not that simple. ASHA workers have been attacked, or more commonly, just ignored.
Only yesterday I was told, don't come near the gate, just leave as quickly as you can. I said, I'll stand on the road, just give me your name and phone number and tell me if this person came by or didn't come by. That's all you have to tell me. They wouldn't say anything.
Experts say there's a pressing need for public education. Misinformation abounds about coronavirus and how it spread, leading to social stigma, or, as we found at the labor site, more immediate worries.
What do I think about coronavirus? I have nothing to eat.
I'll more likely die from hunger before I get coronavirus, he says. For the PBS NewsHour with Rakesh Nagar in Delhi, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in St. Paul, Minnesota.
There are less than 100 days until President Trump faces a Democratic opponent on Election Day in November. John Yang has this week's analysis of the emerging political landscape.
Judy, to mark that moment, we're joined by our Politics Monday team. Amy Walter is the national editor of the Cook Political Report and host of the podcast Politics with Amy Walter. And Tamara Keith is a White House correspondent for NPR.
And host of the NPR Politics podcast.
Thank you. We are 100 days out. We are 100 days out. Polls show that Vice President Biden is leading the president in not only nationally, but also in the battleground states. I have so many Democratic voters come up to me and ask me, given what happened in 2016, is this time different than 2016? Tam, what should I tell them?
Well, there are a lot of answers, but one thing to say is that this has been a very stable lead for former Vice President Biden. And the other thing that is notable and is different from the case in 2016 is that a lot of these polls are showing him above 50%. That is to say that, you know, he's got a majority of voters saying that if the election were held today, they would vote for him. For Hillary Clinton, she did at times have pretty significant leads over over Donald Trump, but she was at, you know, 45%. There was room there in a way that Biden has a more commanding lead. Of course, anything can happen. Anything can change. The Trump campaign insists that the polls are totally skewed. But the other thing that's different is the obvious thing that's different. There's a pandemic. It is affecting everyone's lives. And the president's leadership is a major issue in this campaign and is something that is weighing heavily on voters as relates to the coronavirus.
Amy, Tam said things can change. And the cliche is that 100 days is an eternity in politics. What can change?
Well, I've been asking almost every single campaign strategist I talk with that very question. And first of all, it's important to recognize that 100 days, it is true, it's a little bit less than 100 days until we get to the actual election day. But a lot of states start sending out absentee ballots very soon, in about a little over a month. The state of North Carolina, for example, sends out its ballot. So people are going to actually be receiving ballots in the mail in a lot of these states before we even hit October. So that's a very important thing. The number one issue in my mind is what happens on the pandemic, on the coronavirus pandemic. As Tam pointed out correctly, this is what's driving everything, and it was the major difference between now and 2016. But even if something changes, there's a vaccine that's clearly in the works that maybe gets to go out early 2021. Maybe as schools open, things don't turn out as badly as some people are expecting. The real question in my mind is whether voters are going to give Trump any credit for this. He's lost a lot of credibility on this issue. We've seen his numbers sink now to something like 35-36% approval rating on how he's handled the coronavirus. So the question is, have voters, especially those swing voters, just shut the door on Donald Trump and said, you know what, he mishandled this, he mishandled the George Floyd protests. I'm not going to give him any credit, even if things start to go in the right direction.
Tam, Amy talks about how the pandemic has changed everything. It's even changed the conventions. I mean, the conventions are more than just a time for funny hats and confetti guns and balloon drops. They're a time to get organized, a time to generate excitement. The Democrats are saying they're going to have virtually a 100% virtual convention. The Republicans' plans are still up in the air. What difference is this going to make to the campaigns and the fall campaign?
You know, traditionally, the conventions are multi-day primetime infomercials for the candidates to make their case to the voters unfiltered right there. And, you know, are the networks all going to carry this in the same way? Maybe not. Are they going to have all of these volunteers coming in, getting excited, going back out into their communities, you know, the strongest activists in the party? no, that's not happening. This is a very different situation, a very weird situation. The other thing I would just point out is that in some ways, the conventions have become a metaphor. The Democratic Party realized early on that they likely would need to have a virtual convention, and they've been planning for one. The Republican Party and President Trump were searching for a place where they could hold a traditional convention so they could rub it in the faces of Democrats that they had an in-person convention. They weren't afraid. They were strong. They weren't wearing masks. And that's backfired. And it's not clear that they have a whiz-bang virtual convention in the offing. They may well pull it off, but it is a metaphor for how these things have been going.
Amy, is this putting pressure on the Republicans to, now that the Democrats have this virtual plan, this virtual convention plan?
When you look back over the last 20 so years, what you find is incumbent presidents rarely get a bump from the convention. It's usually the challengers that do. For example, Bill Clinton got a huge bump after the convention, his convention in 1992. So the pressure really is on the Biden campaign. And quite frankly, I think that is going to be more fascinating, in part because not only have we never had a virtual convention, but never have we gone into a convention where the presumptive nominee has spent so little time actually in front of voters. This is going to be the first opportunity for most voters to actually get a sense of who this guy is and to see him in it's a very different kind of environment, but still in a public environment like we haven't seen him before.
Amy Walter, and thanks to Tamara Keith for the assist in the introduction. Thanks. That's Politics Monday.
Thanks.
Finally, during this anniversary week for the ADA, we wanted to take a moment to highlight the achievements of performers, writers, comedians, and artists with disabilities. Their work was featured in a special ceremony streamed over Facebook called ADA 30 Lead On. Here are a few moments from the evening, which had a format much like a variety show. And it included President Bush's speech when he signed the law. It's part of our ongoing arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
I now lift my pen to sign this Americans with Disability Act and say, let the shameful wall of exclusion finally come tumbling down.
There are so many other things that I want to thank the ADA for, but the most important thing, the thing I love the best about the ADA, is that I got to cut the lines at Disney.
For real people?
What's wrong with the little girl? Is that the people in town would ask my grandmother.
I'm the body of a fighter who's constantly at war. I get knocked down 100 times and rise 100 more. When you're someone slightly different, people say things to beware. Like, why pursue a job where they don't want to have you there? A little piece of wisdom passed around from friend to friend says that which doesn't kill us makes us stronger in the end.
I actually just turned 45. Okay, like 2 years ago. And I know a lady is not supposed to tell her age, but I don't care, because at least I'm still at my birth weight.
Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
And so much more talent where that came from. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.